So begin by taking an upright, alert posture. And gently close your eyes. And take a moment first just to check in with yourself, how you are. With the idea that any way that you are is okay. Just going to acknowledge and feel and sense, be present for yourself, for how you are in your body. For how you are in your mind. For how you are in your heart and your feelings. And acknowledging how you are. Perhaps taking a couple of three deep, slow, gentle breaths. And then as you exhale, letting yourself be at ease with how things are. As you exhale, see if you can let go of any tension or holding you carry. Perhaps letting your breath return to normal. And continue for a few breaths to emphasize the exhale. And as you exhale, keep letting go of holding in your body, maybe tension in the shoulders or the belly, the face. As you exhale, letting go the best you can of thoughts, of preoccupations, concerns. Feeling your body, feeling the three-dimensional quality of your body, solidity, as you exhale, see if you can settle deep into your body, so there's a sense of being embodied or resting within the body. Maybe deep down in the belly even, low down, low center of gravity. yourself, be at ease with how things are, even being easy with whatever unease you might feel, being at ease. Perhaps as you exhale, you can let go, relax, soften into a little bit of more ease, a little bit more being here and present with what is, but being easy with it. If you imagine that your thinking mind is a muscle, maybe as you exhale, you can relax the muscle, soften it. Maybe some people like the image of the mind as it relaxes, spreading out, settling out like a choppy water settles out and becomes calm and still. As you exhale, relax the thinking mind, the waves of the mind. Perhaps also as you're sitting here, your emotions and feelings that you might have and hold in the body, that as you exhale, they can settle out, become more expansive, more settled, not to diminish your emotional life, but to let it become broad, expansive, settled, at ease. And then with whatever ease you have now, being at ease with yourself and what's happening, sit here and be mindful, be present for your breath. But notice whatever it is that happens. Notice when you lose your ease. Notice what happens in your mind and your heart and body. In any kind of way you begin losing whatever degree of ease you have. Notice what takes you away from ease. And then bring whatever wisdom you have to bear on that loss of ease. Bring whatever wisdom and you might have to understand and act wisely towards whatever it is that's happening here and now. About losing your ease. important questions, practice questions, for people who have some taste of inner peace or ease. It doesn't have to be much, it can be just a teeny bit. Is why do we sacrifice it? For what will you do you sacrifice that peace for? Is there anything which is worth the sacrifice of giving it up? Have you ever considered that you have a choice? And that in losing your sense of inner ease or peace, that's a choice you've made to leave it in favor of something else. Leaving it in favor of anxiety or worry or ambition or desire, fear. So, good evening, and welcome to our second day of our four-week refuge class. And today we're, I think, primarily explore the second refuge, the refuge in the Dharma. But I'd like to say a few more things generally about refuge, going for refuge. Sometimes in the various Buddhist schools that I know of, I think all of them put emphasis or importance on going for refuge. The whole idea of refuge is very important in Buddhism. So important that some people consider it to be the sign or the movement that where someone decides to become a Buddhist. And some people see it that way, and it's fine to see it that way. It's, if someone wants to become a Buddhist, it's fine with me. But going for refuge doesn't require a person to say they're now a Buddhist. What it is, it is a choice that a person's making about an orientation that they want their life to take. And without, you know, choosing a new orientation, I don't think that going for refuge has much meaning. Now, the various Buddhist traditions share this idea of refuge and the triple refuge, refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Different Buddhist traditions also have sometimes a fourth refuge that's listed. And this is where different Buddhist traditions differ about what the fourth refuge is. In some Buddhist traditions, the fourth refuge is the guru, and you're supposed to take refuge in the guru. In the early Buddhist tradition, in the Theravada tradition, it's quite a contrast, is the fourth refuge is not the guru. The fourth refuge is yourself. You're yourself. Somehow, to take refuge in yourself, there can be no other refuge, the Buddha said. Make your own self a refuge. There's no other refuge. It's one of the last things he said in his last days of the Buddha's life, where he made that emphasis that you yourself can be a refuge. Now we know that each of us can also be our worst enemy. You know, we can be the opposite of refuge for ourselves. But we also have the capacity of being our own refuge, being a place of wisdom, of wise action, of understanding, way of protecting ourselves. In the Dhammapada, there's a very famous verse where it goes like this. Now remember, one of the meanings of refuge is protection. When self indeed is one's own protector, what other protector could there be? With self-control, one gains a protector hard to obtain. So one's own self is one's own protector. Now in terms of the triple refuge, taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, does not mean handing oneself over to a deity, handing oneself over to some metaphysical entity or principle out there, or to a community out there, but rather it has to do with understanding, inspired by the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, seeing ourselves reflected in the possibilities they speak to, and then understanding that there's something for us to do in going for refuge. It's a choice we make to find how can we be our own protector, how can we be our own refuge. So in the Dhammapada also, there's another place where he talks about refuge. It says, people threatened by fear go to many refuges. That's pretty common, right? And so people go all kinds of places. You can name them. They go to religious institutions, practices. They go to charms. They go to amulets. They go to their banks, stock market. They go to their homes. They go to their friends. They go all kinds of places for refuge. People threatened by fear go to many refuges. To mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. So you can kind of fill in all the different places people tend to go for refuge. And you can question them. Is it really providing a refuge? And you might not take your bank as an ultimate refuge. But to some degree, emotionally, people often do. And when suddenly the bank goes upside down, people feel really disturbed sometimes. It's something. Remember a woman who was very disturbed going through a big earthquake in Yucca Valley during her meditation retreat. And she saw the desert there kind of just buckle like a wave. And she thought, that Mother Earth was a place of refuge. It was stable, secure, firm, and you could rely on it. And it was kind of, unnerving for her that this thing that she had relied on so much couldn't be relied on in that way. So, many of the things we kind of emotionally take refuge in or rely on ultimately are not reliable. And they can disappear quickly here for us, very quickly, a lot of things. But here, one of the important lines is his last line. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. Released from all suffering. That's really the kind of the emphasis in the Buddha's teaching, is what is it that helps you become free of all suffering? Not just some suffering, but all your suffering. Is there, the Buddha and Buddha's offering a path, a practice, a teaching, and a model of someone who's done the work of releasing oneself from suffering. So it's a very high task in some ways. It's a very noble task. And going for refuge in the Buddhist tradition, in this early Buddhist tradition, in Theravada tradition, is to have some sense of that possibility of being free of suffering, having that peace, that happiness that it comes with the absence of suffering, and then orienting towards that. That's the primary orientation, to live a life that somehow can move towards freedom from suffering in ourselves and for others also. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the ending of suffering, then this is the secure refuge, this is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. So here, the supreme refuge is maybe this is a fifth refuge. The supreme refuge is seeing with the right insight, with true insight, the Four Noble Truths. There's an understanding, there's a vision that comes. And seeing the Four Noble Truths is, here it says a supreme refuge. This is the refuge that can really count, really help you. So somehow you see the suffering, you see the cause of that suffering, and you see the possibility of being free from it. You see the possibility of the ending of that clinging or that cause. Or you see, and if you can't do it directly, you see a path, you see a way of living that can help you loosen the grip of the clinging which is producing suffering. This is beginning to see how we are our own protector, how we are provide for our own well-being and welfare. Because the suffering that the Buddha is pointing towards here is a suffering that somehow or other is generated in our own psyche, our own mind, by the way in which we cling, resist, contract around our life, what's going on. And in that we do that, that clinging and the resistance, that contraction, it's up to us to release it. Conditions in the world can sometimes get us to relax, and we can get relief from our clinging, from our suffering. But relief is not the same thing as release. And what the Buddhist tradition is looking for is how can we be released from the clinging, not just simply calm it down so we don't feel it so much, so it's kind of in the background or hidden for a while, but how to get down into the roots of our being, so that tendency to cling is somehow relaxed and released. So that's really something that has to happen within us. And so is entering the Buddhist path or going for refuge, there has to be some understanding or some inkling or some intuition that the path to freedom, the path to, is somehow found within ourselves. And so going for refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha is not meant to be kind of, the Buddha Dharma Sangha is not meant to be like this teddy bear that's supposed to kind of reassure you. Just only that. It certainly can be a very important source of reassurance, but a reassurance that kind of points you back to where the path, practice, the work really is. And so here, oneself is one's own refuge when one sees the Four Noble Truths in one's experience. So, one of the primary meanings of the Dharma here, taking refuge in the Dharma, is taking refuge in the Four Noble Truths, taking refuge in the teachings of the Buddha, but more than just seeing the Four Noble Truths as teaching, but as it says here, seeing the Four Noble Truths, seeing it with right insight, seeing it for yourself, that this is how things work. So not just believing it because you read it in a text, but somehow discerning, seeing, understanding in some new way. That makes it, it's personal, that's direct. It's really something you've discovered for yourself, not because you've read it in a book. You might have started in a book, but you see, you have a sense, either directly or very strong intuition, this really applies, this is really the way it is. And so it's said in the ancient commentaries of the Theravada tradition that one of the important aspects of going for refuge is understanding. That you have to understand. There has to be some kind of something has to kind of come alive for us in our understanding of ourselves, our life, and suffering, and the freedom of suffering. Something has to come kind of, there has to be some understanding. Again, it comes, falls back to us. We have to understand. We have to do the work to try to understand. And not just simply rely on, you know, some kind of refuge, you know, that's outside of us that we're going to kind of go to and pray to. And then the idea of, as I said last week, the word refuge, the formula for going for refuge is Buddham Saranam Gacchami. And Gacchami means to walk. And I love that it says to walk. Because sometimes in English we hear people say, I took refuge. I'm going to go take refuge. You know, it's like appropriating, right? I'm going to take it for myself. You know, now I have it. But going for refuge, is the word literally means walk. Gacchami means to walk. So, in Pali. So I'm going to walk. It's something you do with your whole body. You walk your walk, right? You talk your talk. So you walk with your whole body. You're going to walk into something. You're going to put yourself into it, your whole being. You're going to put yourself into this, into a practice, into an understanding, into an orientation that you're going to try to live by. So it's something you do. It's something, again, the emphasis is here, ourselves. So the meditation that I offered you this evening around ease was in part trying to point to this, and I don't know what it meant for any of you, but exercise. When one of the simplest instructions for meditation that I've ever heard was from Ajahn Amaro, a Buddhist monk. And his instruction was, set your mind at ease. He didn't say how much ease, just set your mind at ease. Something that we qualify as ease. Maybe it's relative to where you're at. Set yourself at your mind at ease. And then notice what takes you away from it. That's it. That's the entire meditation instruction. Maybe that's all you need to know. Set yourself at ease and notice what takes you away from it. And the whole path unfolds and from there. But to pay attention, to have some sense of ease, and then pay careful attention to what happens that takes you away from there. What kind of concerns? What grabs you? So you're sitting here, and you have some ease, you're very calm and settled perhaps, and suddenly this thought arises in the mind that, you know, there's no cereal at home for breakfast in the morning. Well, that's a reasonable thing to happen. It could be a real thing. Maybe some of you don't have cereal at home. And then your mind jumps onto that thought. Well, I wonder what supermarket's open this evening. I need to get home and get to sleep early enough, so it's kind of hard to go shopping. I wonder which store I can go to that's the quickest. And I wonder if I can kind of sneak out, sit kind of near the edge of the carpet there. I wonder if maybe no one will notice me, and I don't want anybody to notice that I'm trying to leave, but because, you know, I'm supposed to be paying attention, but probably aren't a lot of police around this time of night, and probably I can kind of go a little bit faster than speed limit to get to that store, to get that cereal, so I can get home and get a good night's sleep, so I can get up in the morning and have my cereal. I can go on, right, with the story. the mind gets caught up in these stories, but as it's caught up in the story, it isn't just kind of like this idle, drifting thought. There's an emotional relationship to that. Maybe there's a little bit of worry and fear, and it's kind of, you grabbed on to this little silly little thought, and you don't notice how in doing that you've sacrificed your ease. You had some ease, some little bit of peace, some calm perhaps, and then off you go and spend 5 minutes on this amazing adventure of trying to buy cereal until finally it occurs to you, oh, you know, actually I do have it there in that back cupboard. What a waste of time to have thought about all that. So what do you sacrifice your ease for? Is a very profound question. What do you sacrifice your peace for? And if you stopped every time you noticed that you kind of gave up some degree of peace, some degree of well-being, of calm, and questioned what just happened, you would learn a phenomenal amount about your life, about what motivates you and how you tick, how you work. And not only if you stop and try to investigate it, but then you question it. Start asking questions of it. Is this really worth it? Is this really appropriate? Is this what do I believe? What does it say about what I believe is important? Sort of question. Look into that. So in doing this exercise this evening of having some ease and then looking at what takes you away from it and then looking at how to relate to it wisely, there's a number of elements here. One is that it's up to you to establish your mind at ease. That's really your task. It's like peeing. You can't ask someone to pee for you. You know, you got to do that. So putting your mind, your heart at ease, at peace, is something that you do. And then, so you have some responsibility there about that, the state of your mind, state of your heart. And then you can have a practice of paying enough attention, somehow or other, to notice sooner or later, maybe it's later, when you've sacrificed that ease, when you've left it, when it's gone. And then you can engage that in a wise way. You can engage it with, certainly with compassion, with a certain kind of acceptance. But you also can engage it with a sense of inquiry, of trying to understand, of questioning it. And if you have good understanding of what's going on, perhaps it's appropriate to let go of it or do something, practice with it. So this is a kind of to find that we have this amazing potential in each of us. Amazing potential to engage in our life, in our mind, in our heart, so that we could not sacrifice a sense of well-being, a sense of deep peace and ease. I think this is it's like we have this amazing jewel, and then we cover over the jewel. And we assume that it has to be that way. We assume that it's inherent in human life that we have to cover that jewel by worrying or being preoccupied or whatever it might be. I know one of the interesting places around this question of why sacrifice your peace is some people feel that unless they worry for their friends, they don't really care, and so they have to show their worry. They have to worry and fret or something, and that's really how they show their love or their care. But is that really the case? I would ask you to question that. Is it possible to meet your friends wholeheartedly and wisely and compassionately without giving up that covering over that jewel of your well-being? So the triple refuge, Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, is sometimes called the triple jewel. And it's these really precious things because they're like jewels that they're mirrors that are reflecting back to a jewel inside ourselves. So then some people might say, well, this is a lot of emphasis here on oneself, taking refuge in oneself, one's own peace. It's beginning to sound kind of self-centered, self-preoccupied, narcissistic maybe even. And that's certainly that's the near enemy. The near enemy in Buddhism is something that looks like a wholesome quality. So something that looks, it looks so close that you could confuse it for the ideal. So the near enemy of, for example, of loving kindness, is the tradition talks about sensual craving, sexual craving. Often in the modern Vipassana world, we talk about the near enemy of loving kindness as being clinging love. It's still kind of a love, but it's kind of clinging. Loving kindness has no clinging as part of it. So the near enemy of spiritual endeavors, of the spiritual life, spiritual practice, is narcissism. And it's because sometimes it's confused for, you know, spiritual life. So it's an important issue, the gray line between narcissism and the spiritual practice. But seeing oneself as a refuge and this emphasis on being responsible for oneself, I would argue, has nothing to do with being selfish at all. It's actually the antidote. It's the medicine for selfishness, because selfishness is a way of covering the jewel. Selfishness is a form of losing our peace, our ease, our well-being. There's a kind of tightness or kind of constriction or kind of suffering inherent in being selfish. And as that selfishness kind of diminishes, then the natural, the inherent kind of response of that jewel, of that kind of sensitivity, of that ease, is to respond to the world compassionately. And so what the Theravada tradition says is that if two people are sunk in, or not sunk, but two people are stuck in quicksand, and one tries to pull up the other one, that's very nice, it's very compassionate. But they're both standing in quicksand, then one will, you know, the one that's trying to pull up the other one will just sink down further. And they'll just kind of like, you know, go further and further down as they try pulling each other out. One of them has to get up on dry land and then reach over to be able to pull up the person who's in the quicksand. So in the same way, in spiritual life, someone has to discover the capacity for inner peace and well-being. Someone has to know that in order from that place to be able to help someone else or reflect someone else or show someone else or, you know, be of aid. Because there certainly is a danger when people are confused and lost in their suffering, they try to help each other, that actually sometimes they just kind of sink together. So it can be argued then that taking care of our own heart and well-being is a very compassionate thing to do for the world also, because then we become more available with very different eyes, with very different understanding, very different presence than if we, you know, try to engage in the world before we're ready. So the going for refuge in the Dharma has a variety of meanings. One meaning is that it's the teachings of the Buddha. And some people like to read the teachings of the Buddha, and some people don't care to. Either way is fine. But my experience of reading the teachings of the Buddha is that the more I read, the more amazed I am at those teachings. They just blow me away, the more I understand them. There was a time when I first started reading the suttas and the teachings of the Buddha, they put me to sleep. They're hard to get into, they're hard to read. At least for me it was. But once I kind of got into it and understand what was being talked about, and the more amazing system of teachings that I'm so impressed by what I see there. And so for me, you know, taking refuge in the Dharma is also involves some deep appreciation in those teachings. And so I go to those teachings for wisdom, for reflection, to be challenged. I like being challenged by teachings. I like to read things that don't always sit well with me and then engage with them, you know, and question them and debate them in my mind and what's going on here. So one of the meanings of Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha. Another meaning of Dharma is the practices that the Buddha taught. The practices and the results of those practices, what happens to you as you practice. So the practices of mindfulness is a Dharma. And the insights that come with the practice of mindfulness is the Dharma. The practice of concentration, the practice of loving kindness and compassion. All the practices and the results, how we're changed by those practices, these are all the Dharma. A third meaning of Dharma is that Dharma is the way things are. It's an expression which is very popular in Buddhism, the way things are. That there's a natural order, a natural pattern, or sometimes in English we say there's a natural law or pattern or by which things unfold. And to take refuge in that pattern is to take refuge in relating to that pattern wisely, to align ourselves with the wisdom of it, to be in harmony with that pattern, what it means is that part of the pattern is that if you spend time lying or stealing or harming other people, that has certain consequences. And it's kind of a natural thing. It's kind of like a natural law, kind of natural pattern. And if you spend a lot of time hurting people, that's going to condition and shape your psyche, your mind, your heart in such a way that it's going to have results for you down the line. There's going to be karmic consequences, they say. And that's a natural pattern, natural law. If you live with generosity and live with kindness and with compassion, that has different results. It's kind of a natural pattern that goes on there. So to take refuge in the way things are is take refuge that we can align ourselves with the pattern, with these psychological patterns, so that we move in the direction of betterment, of freedom, of compassion, So the Dharma has these three primary meanings: the teachings of the Buddha, the practices and the results of the practices, and then the patterns or the laws or the kind of the nature of how things are. I don't know if I've explained the last one very well, but this last one is very important for me because there are times in my life where things are not going the way they should. That's usual. But sometimes, you know, I would maybe think of them as being, this is serious. Maybe like a crisis is happening. Or some situation where my poor little mind cannot understand what to do, how to respond, what's going on. For me to take refuge in the Dharma is take refuge in that there's something else is operating, something else is unfolding here. Besides, there's more than maybe I can understand. And if I show up and stay present and be mindful and try to do my practice of not getting contracted, not getting caught in my fear, not getting caught in my greed, but try to stay present for what's going on, that if I keep doing that, that then the situation becomes trustable. Then something will evolve, something will happen through that. Things tend to work out. Now, maybe that's superstitious, I don't know. But the longer I've done this practice, the more I trust the tremendous power of showing up, being mindful, and how that then something, the law, the nature of how things unfold, being an unfolding in ways where things are safe. Reality is safe if we're present. If we're not present, then it's not safe. So if we're present and mindful, and so as I've done this mindfulness practice for so many years, that's for me one of the very profound insights or understandings that I fall back on and understand, is that even if I don't understand what's happening, what I can do is I can bring myself and probably be present and mindful and non-reactive. And in that non-reactive presence, that's quite powerful to what the situation is. So the idea of refuge, I think for some people has the most meaning when they are in crisis. When, you know, it's been said many times, maybe I've said it too many times. Maybe I said it last week even, apologize. You know, the danger of teaching a lot. You don't remember where you said something. Friends of mine who are meditation teachers in Hawaii, did I tell you about that story in Hawaii? They say that when they offer one-day sittings in Hawaii, very few people come. And the reason is that in Hawaii, if you're not feeling very good, you just go to the beach. And so you know, you have this kind of wonderful way of kind of, you know, getting relief. But what happens when there's a big crisis? Today I talked to a person who just was diagnosed with cancer. And then an hour or two later, someone came up to me and said, oh, you know, so-and-so was also diagnosed with cancer. And suddenly someone who had a very privileged life, one of the people had a very privileged life, very, very privileged, a very wealthy life. And suddenly, you know, all that privilege, you know, she has this crisis, she has cancer now. So what does she rely on now for her cancer? And what she rely on? And what she rely on? So taking the refuge is a, you know, the idea of refuge, what do we rely on? What offers us support? What offers us a path? What offers us a way to deal with this and respond to this? So we're not just kind of the hapless victims, the helpless victims who are kind of just pushed around and swayed by what's going on. And what helps us so that we can rely on ourselves and not just depend on the doctors or depend on other people to fix things. But how can we depend on ourselves so we maintain a certain degree of freedom, of dignity, of nobility, of presence, no matter what's happening? So in times of crisis, I think the refuges have a tremendous meaning. And maybe in crisis, we don't know what to do. We don't see our way out. But I know for many Buddhists, that's a time they like to remind themselves of the refuges. Oh yeah, I have the refuges at least. There is a way. There is a path. And now my task is to find out what that is. But these refuges, and for some Buddhists, it's a very emotional connection to the refuges. It's not intellectual, you know, only an intellectual understanding. It's a very deep, heartfelt kind of emotional connection, bordering on what some people might call devotion. But I think devotion isn't quite the right word, because in English, at least, that the word devotion somehow implies, you know, handing yourself over to something outside of yourself. And I don't know quite that's what's right in Buddhist practice. So I've said a lot, and I have no idea how this sits with you, but I've tried to give you some sense of my understanding of refuge in the Dharma, or what some of the things might mean here. And I'm hoping what I've said is enough, that now you guys can engage a little bit on this topic. What do you think it means to take refuge in the Dharma? Not what do you think it means, that's not right. What does it mean for you? What would you like it to mean? What do you think it could mean for you? Because if you're going to go through the refuge ceremony, for example, this has to be something you do because you have some personal connection to it. So this is your chance to kind of explore that. What is your understanding of the Dharma here? What's your understanding of taking refuge in the Dharma? What value does it have for you? Or maybe it's an intuition you have. Maybe you don't have a clear, articulated idea, but maybe you have some intuition or hunch of what it might mean for you or why it's significant. So what I thought it would be nice is again, as last week, is to break into small groups so you can hear from each other and talk. And maybe spend maybe 15 minutes in a small group discussing that, and then we'll reform as the bigger group. And if for some reason any of you feel like you don't want to sit in the group and talk, you can just sit quietly here and wait until we regroup. But I'd encourage you to think about doing the groups. And for me, it's also okay if you don't want to speak, if you join a group anyway, and just kind of bow and explain, I don't really feel like talking, but so you hear other people. At least I'm not going to be in the group, so it's easy for me to say. But because I want to respect, sometimes people feel shy, appropriately shy sometimes, about speaking what's maybe very tender inside of them. So I think groups of five would be really good. And that's my thought. Last week I think there were groups of six. So can you try to self-select into groups of five? And if there probably will be a few people who don't fit into a group of five. If that's the case, just stay standing, and that'll help you figure out what to do next. You will not be abandoned.